White Boys Podcast. We show entertainment stuff. Billy and Seth, David and Billy, and David and Seth, and Billy again. This is the best show in the entire world. Movies, TV, video games. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to White Noise Weekly on the White Noise Podcast. This is episode number 15.
You've got the paper, man. This is 16.
It's episode 16. I always had confidence in myself that I knew what the number was. Anyways, I'm Billy White. Joining me this week, obviously, is Seth Juniak.
Yeah.
Thoughts and prayers with David as he deals, you know, his family deals some issues, and we, like, you know, hopefully that'll be, he'll be back soon, and we wish him the best of luck.
We don't have any funny anecdote just because it is kind of serious and it's in poor taste. We aren't animals.
As you say this while laughing, you're kind of like laughing there as you say all that stuff.
I mean, it's just, you know, my bubbly personality.
Oh, it's just so cute. That's why you love you, Seth.
Yeah, something.
I said earlier today, I was like, I think your life sometimes is just like one giant meme in the way you talk and act, and I love it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's no Nick Pizzolatto with the way, you know, everything that I say is, you know, just has an extra bite to it, you know. I don't use apoplexic and random stuff. I don't even know if that was the word. Those kind of words don't come up in everyday conversation, but they do every now and then.
You think he's just, like, looking at the dictionary, like, apoplexic,
Yeah, he's got it, and he's just, like, he's the frat boy turning in the paper late, but, you know, doesn't want to make it seem like he didn't try, so he, like, thesauruses every word, doesn't even look at it. Again, he's just like, apoplexic, that looks good. Then he just types it in, you know, puts it in, and then...
It's almost like he's, like, saying, I don't know, indubitably, without really knowing what it means, to answer everything.
You know, indubitably, that sounds like something that's possible.
So, I don't know if I want to start with 7 Days in Hell, which is what we're referencing there, which is a HBO documentary. It's a documentary. I like to refer to it as an HBO sports documentary.
I like to think it actually happened. But,
yeah, me too.
But, you know, I think it's, yeah.
And there's obviously the new True Detective episode, which I have thoughts on both of them. I have so many thoughts on both of them. But dealing with your frat boy reference, I'm pretty sure that his assignment was turning late. I'm pretty sure that the idea of not giving him 2 years when he writes everything himself, and he probably had the first season of some passion project for a long time, I think they really should give him 2 years, because this feels like a rushed school assignment that got done at the last second, and he'll get a passing grade in the end, because some elements are really great, but for the most part, it's just a mess.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's just so strange that when I think of passion project, too, there's a right way and a wrong way to do your passion project. Let's take Christopher Nolan, for instance. I think his passion project was Interstellar. And as a result, I think Interstellar is the best movie that he made outside of Dark Knight. But for some reason, I don't know, Nick Pizzolatto, we thought he was so good after the first season because it was. I mean, the whole package of True Detective was pretty good. We can nitpick here and there, but that's all they are, is nitpicks. And, you know, now all of a sudden we're seeing basically the same written word, but everything else around it has changed, and it hasn't kept, you know, I don't think. But let's start with 7 Days of Hell.
7 Days of Hell is more fun.
I'd rather start with that, just because, you know, it was the most important thing I saw this week.
So, it's Sunday night, right? Mm-hmm. True Detective aired. I was like, okay, I should watch True Detective, and then I watched 7 Days in Hell, because I really wanted to see it. Now, this is a, essentially, like I said, it's a fake, you know, documentary on the longest tennis match that ever happened, which is why it's called 7 Days in Hell. It took 7 days at Wimbledon, and it's the cast, I'm just going to say the cast in a nutshell. So, John Hamm narrates it, of course. You have Andy Samberg and Kit Harington, who's Jon Snow, if you don't know his name, as the two main guys, you know? But you also have, like, Lena Dunham. You also have Will Forte. You have Michael Sheen. Fred Armisen, David Copperfield's in it, and he has my favorite line in the whole thing, Serena Williams, Flip Hammer, Chris Everett, Jim Lampley, John McEnroe, June Squibb is Queen Elizabeth.
And of course, Mary Steenburgen, who's always good as, you know, she's always good at the type of character she plays. Which is just kind of the mother, but. And then I feel that we should also point out June Squibb.
She's Queen Elizabeth, which is one of the best roles in the whole movie or documentary. And it's like HBO Sports. You know, HBO Sports does do documentaries. It's like, okay, guys, you're gonna work on this project that's not really a documentary, and it's gonna be glorious. And it's essentially in a nutshell. It's okay. So Aaron Williams, who Andy Samberg's character. He is, you could say, you did it better earlier today. What is his character?
Aaron Williams is just, you know, he's like the Floyd Mayweather of tennis, is a good way of putting it. He's just this guy who is really, really good, but just does all this controversial stuff, and it drives him out of the game, and then he comes back because Kit Harington talks some shit about him.
And it's like Aaron Williams is... the adopted, he's like the reverse blind side of Serena Williams.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
He was adopted by Richard Williams, you know, and he ended up playing tennis, and he, like, does a bunch of crazy things, you know, and what happens is he's number two player in the world, he's almost going to be number one, 1996 Wimbledon finals, you know, championship point, and his serve hits the line judge, who has a heart attack and dies. So he has this huge lead, and ended up losing the championship, and then everyone calls him a murderer. So he then pushes the Duke of Kent. And that was the push hurt. Howie Mandel was the Duke of Kent, by the way. which is like the push hurt around the world. And then he falls a spiraling, you know, out of control from there. And then he ends up in a Swedish prison that has lots of penises.
What is it? It's like if you are going to end up in prison... Swedish prison is the one to end up in. Let's go ahead and talk about the Swedish prison real quick, because I said something and, you know, I'll own up to it right now. There was a lot of male nudity in this. A lot more than average male nudity, and that's in and of itself is whatever, but the part of it that is the controversial thing, I think it was refreshing. I mean, we always see, you know, we always see some boobs, we always see some, you know, butts in HBO stuff, but this time we saw some boobs, we saw some butts, but not nearly as much as the amount of dicks we saw.
This is sad. You know, I haven't seen enough dicks lately in my HBO shows.
Look, it may or may not have been a little perturbed by it, but I couldn't stop laughing every time I saw it, just because, like,
it's not that
there's just dicks. It's like, you know, a Dr. Seuss book of dicks, right? One dick, two dicks, red dick, blue dick, long dick, short dick. There's so many, and I couldn't stop laughing.
And, like, what happened was, like, when he escaped from prison, they had this, like, Swedish male orgy. And, like, but they had, like, a unique animated version of it, you know? That kind of looks like Crash Test Dummies to a certain degree. And, like, when he's escaping, it's, like, really animated. He's, like, using it to, like, hit, like, guards and stuff, and it's super long, and... I don't know. It was, the whole thing was just hilarious.
One thing I will also say too about that before we stray too far away. Interesting fact. Grantland interviewed Andy Samberg for the, you know, 7 Days of Hell. And it was one of the things he said too is not just the amount of dicks and how, you know, that's something new. They did not. What's the easiest way to put it? The amount of sexual positions, too, might be the most that's ever been in a movie. and they also didn't do reverse cowgirl, because if you see anything, it's always a reverse cowgirl. But they purposefully didn't do that.
So they had a before we get to the actual match itself, whatever, the other side of the coin is Kit Harington's character, Charles Poole. And he's like the child prodigy, where his mother made him, at the age of three, you know, he was considered a prodigy because his mom essentially made him, you know, be a test player, to the point that instead of getting an education, he got a degree as a truck driver, vocational school, and, like, he's really stupid. And because he's really stupid, his mom just tells him to say indubitably to everything, or he heard indubitably somewhere, so he says indubitably to everything, and that's his, he doesn't even really know what it means, probably, that's his answer to try to sound smart, and then Michael Sheen hits on him in a very weird way.
Yeah, I know it. And... just the whole thing is just so hammed up, no pun intended, being the narrator, but the whole thing is just so...
hammed up, really?
Like and by that I mean that, you know, the tennis match is shot on old cameras, the Kit Harington and interviews or whatever, right? The interviews were shot on old cameras, you know, recorded with old microphones. It just has this feel about it, too, that, you know, it the kind of brilliant thing about the comedy of it, though, is that it isn't silly, but, the you know, the tone isn't really silly, but the, it's the kind of thing, like, take, for instance, Serena Williams, where she's just, you know, she says it with the straightest face, deadest pan, you know. Yeah, my, you know, Aaron Williams is my adopted brother, you know, it's like the reverse blind side. It's like, she says it straight, you know, straightest face, nothing, you know, there's no humor to it, but it's like, the thing that makes it funny is that tone and just how preposterous the things she's saying actually are. And the whole documentary does a good job at, like, balancing that, you know, that tone, because if it wasn't grounded in seriousness and reality, then it wouldn't be funny. And, you know, the silliness can really show out when it really is silly, but they do a good job about establishing an even tone, which is so important in a movie like this. You know, they shoot for that, like, airplane type of, you know, humor where, you know, the jokes were kind of sneaked in and they come in really quick and, you know, you could miss them if you blink, but because they, you know, establish the tone really well, you don't miss them. And that's really something that, you know, from a comedic standpoint, it really works and is, I don't want to say it's a marvel just because of, you know, I don't think it's a masterpiece, but it was pretty funny and, you know, expertly created in terms of making people laugh.
Yeah, tonally, it's a very unique, as you pointed out, it's a very tonally unique thing in how it does it. Because like I said, it is kind of like watching a documentary, except for the fact that it's, you know, Will Forte and Fred Armisen being, you know, two of the main guys, you know, commentating stuff. Or Lena Dunham keeps showing up, you know, with her clothing line. And it's, so what happened is Charles Polis' character ends up being in the match because he's like, the guy asks him, so do you think you are better than, you know, Aaron Williams? He's like, yeah.
Indubitably.
I didn't say that. He's like, yeah. Yeah, it's just like, it's a very casual, you know, line that Aaron Williams heard, and that's what really inspired him to be back in shape. Granted, in the actual tennis match himself, half the reason that he was able to fight him, you know, play really well against him in the tennis match was because he was, like, snorting cocaine from his rackets and on the line. And my favorite line of the entire thing, David Copperfield was like, you have to remember back then cocaine wasn't illegal, or cocaine was legal back then. And I was like, cocaine's never been legal. Oh, really?
They just keep finding ways to, you know, it's just such a parody of so many things. It's a parody of tennis. It's a parody of sports in general. It's a parody of you know, the ESPN 30 for 30. And, you know, it's just so funny how it's all put together. And, you know, the timing of it, too. Wimbledon just happened, and I think that was a really good move to release it when they did. So,
yeah, having the Queen of England beat up where the bruises won't show in an elevator.
The idea of Queen Elizabeth, you know, the British Queen, drunk dialing someone and calling them a cock slut is just.
I said the fact that she actually shows up and beats him up, like, where the bruises won't show. The bruises won't show. That's what she did.
I think it's just yeah, no, it's really, there's so much to like about this movie. I don't think there was any wasted time. I mean, it's expertly created, and it was a genuine surprise, you know?
Yeah, speaking of this, so you mentioned the sexual positions, right? What happens is, this is the last, we don't really have to go too much more into this, you know, we don't want to do a full recap, but, like, what happens is, in the documentary, this one streaker runs on the court, Williams ends up having sex with her, right? Mm-hmm. And when he's done, a male streaker comes in, who Williams also has sex with, and then the female streaker runs back on the court, and they have a threesome, so the match is suspended because the sex took so long.
And then, you know, of course, you know, Charles Poole just really, that was such a perturbing thing for him, and, you know, and then, like, the press conference afterwards, right, you know, hey, I'm not going to apologize for what happened yesterday. I think it was all, you know, I left it there on the court, man.
And I'm actually, and then he's like, oh, I'm also English.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's honestly, like, obviously, we've done a lot of spoilers, so I'm hoping people who are listening to watch it at the same time. Like, there's so much more in that movie, great.
Look, watch it. It's probably even worth a rewatch, too, just because there's, you know, there's so much there, and it's, like I said, it was a genuine surprise, and, you know, even if you don't like Andy Samberg or don't like, you know, just watch it. I thought it was really great.
yeah, I had so much fun watching this. And then I had to watch another thing on HBO, which had actually the most fun sequence. And when I say fun, I mean interesting or exciting sequence mm-hmm. of any Star Trek episode with the ending. But before we get on to that, before we get to this actual episode itself, I'm telling you, this pretty much is, okay, I did a phenomenal job of True Detective Season 1. Yeah, I'm on top of the world. Oh, HBO wants me to have a second season next year. Crap. No, I can do this. I did the first season by myself. I can do this. And then, like, 6 months later, all he's typed is the word the, like in SpongeBob when he's writing his paper.
No, like, no, that's not a proper thing. You know, he pretty much copied and pasted the script from season one of True Detective and, you know, changed the setting. He's like, oh, crap, they'll catch me if I do two characters again. Got it, four characters.
Well, it's kind of funny. It's like, season one worked for many reasons because, one, Russ Cole was one of the most unique, fascinating characters ever in television, but also it was a very grounded show with, you know, Marty, Woody Harrelson. It was very focused between those two characters and their lives, and it was able to, you know, wrap those two characters. It was really a character study within the detective genre, but at least the plot was still very tied together with the characters. This is four characters. All of them are trying to be like Russ Cole in some way or another, and the plot doesn't make any sense. Like, the ending has this awesome, phenomenal scene where the incompetent police, you know, essentially thinks it'll be this easy job, and most of them end up getting killed by gangsters, you know, and drug people. And, like, and it kind of tells you, like, okay, well, it's this very thrilling, well-done, captured scene with a lot of tension. But it's also like, wait, after I watched it, I'm like, that was incredible. Wait, why did that happen again? What was the point of having this happen?
Yeah,
I think they briefly mentioned it before the scene started.
Yeah, this was episode 4. This is where they whipped out the big action set piece in Season Detective True 1 is what I'm saying. True Detective Season 1.
Oh, yes, I love Season Detective True 1.
episode 4 was when they whipped out probably, and I'm saying this with, you know, a good amount of certainty, probably the best action set piece ever on a television screen. In Who Goes There, which was the single shot Fukunaga did for the Rust's drug bust.
Serious question. Hard Home versus the ending this episode 4 of season 1 of True Detective.
In terms of degree of difficulty, I will probably have to go with Who Goes There in terms of, like, you know, some, I don't know. The thing about Hard Home is some of the beyond the margin stuff kind of feels it.
It's also like 20 minutes. It's 20 something minutes long versus like a 5 minute or 4 minute, you know, single take.
Yeah, and like I said, it's really difficult, but, you know, just every time someone wants, you know, someone wants to see a good piece of filmmaking, I recommend it, you know, first and foremost, go to that True Detective 5 minute tracking shot just because it is phenomenal. There's so much going on there, and it's, visually, it's excellent, but it's like, you know, the camera is not really, you're seeing it through the prism of the character, but, like, so much more. And every wall has a secret to it. It's like, that scene alone is one of the greatest things ever. So it makes sense that they would go back to it with, you know, season two. The problem is, you know, there is a lot to like about it, you know, and don't get me wrong, but I don't necessarily like that they're trying to replicate something that, not even lightning in a bottle. I mean, that assumes that it was uncontrollable. I mean, it was controlled the whole way in that Who Goes There tracking shot. This one just kind of, you know, Padez was a different kind of director, has a different kind of sensibility. He's great at action. I mean, he's I think he's done stuff for The Pacific. He did the Iwo Jima.
Yeah, he did the Iwo Jima battle sequence.
And even he did some good work for Game of Thrones. It's not what he's known for, but, you know, he's a good TV director, and, you know, he's the guy you want to front this. But that's kind of, Fukunaga elevated this beyond the medium, you know, and that's kind of the difference. I think that, you know, the down will come in season two. This worked well within the medium. It stretched it, but it didn't bust it. That's what Fukunaga did in season one, and that's why comparing the two is a dangerous thing, because I frankly don't think this one was close. That being said, in a vacuum, it was great. I you know, the characters, in terms of, you know, you talked about this being a detective show, but the character, you know, a character study surrounded by a detective show. Let's take this action sequence, for instance. You know, we learned so much about each of the three characters there. You know, Colin Farrell's character, Velcoro, Velcoro is a guy who, you know, right before the car drive going into it, basically he would, you know, say, hey, you're a survivor to Taylor Kitsch's character, Woodrow. Hey, you're a survivor. And then, you know, what happens at the end of that fight? You know, Velcoro, a guy who's been kind of, you know, hanging tight and loose or something. I don't know what you want to say. He survived, and he's just, you know, a survivor, and that's all he really has been. He's, you know, kind of been walked through his last couple weeks of life, just, you know, not really having much purpose. And
Woodrow's character.
And Woodrow's,
jump in real quick. Yeah,
Woodrow's character. I mean, can you go ahead and take it, since you know where I'm going.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty much so. You have a character who's been established through, you know, you knew something kind of traumatic happened back when he was in the army. He has PTSD. And seeing him finally within his own element again, like, he never seemed more alive, more confident, more sure of himself than in that scene. If you notice, he's the one who took down pretty much the two biggest threats in the different gun angles. Like, it's kind of funny. It's like watching this guy go back into his element after everything you saw him. He's an interesting character from the evolution of what, you know, he's one of the more interesting done characters, probably in some ways the most consistently well-done character on this show from a pure writing standpoint. And it was cool kind of seeing him get back in the action considering everything else in his life going so wrong for him. This is actually what he lives for. So the ending scene where you see Velcoro kind of breaking down, you see Annie kind of like, you know...
Also breaking down.
breaking down, yeah. And he's just kind of like just saying, like, okay, confident control.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, we see... God, Taylor Kitsch has just acted the hell out of this role, and it's both disappointing and, you know, not surprising. I mean, like I said, anyone who's seen Kitsch do his, you know, other stuff, chiefly being Riggins and Friday Night Lights, know that he's got this in him. And frankly, this is an older, gayer version of Riggins. You know, and just really his character has been very well done, and I agree with you too. And then there's also, you know, kind of rounding it out, You kind of also touched on it, Annie's character also. That's the thing that made this fight scene really brilliant, was because it is, like you said, a character study surrounded by a set piece. You know, Annie, you know, quite literally bringing a knife to a gunfight. Just, she's out of her depth at every corner. And, you know, and then Velcoro breaking down, and just, you know, this is something that he doesn't want to be this. He doesn't want to be a part of this. And like I said, the only reason that Kitsch's calmness is so noticed is because of how well he's acted before. You know, he cursed the crap out of losing his motorcycle. You know, that scene to me is the spectrum, right? You need to establish something so you can appreciate another moment. So the calmness is further reflected by just how out of sorts he was not 20 minutes ago.
Interesting, you know, Annie, she's a character who you saw her having, you know, being accused of inappropriate relationships with the different people in the agency. She's a very angry character. And seeing her kind of be out of her, you know, out of her league for a person who portrays to be this tough, you know, she has lots of gambling debts. You know, she's the, you know, very physical, violent person. And then being in the sequence kind of dialed her back a little bit. And it's going to be interesting to see how that changed her. But the main, as phenomenally does sequence was, as much as I like seeing how it affects different characters, it still was, you know, what's the point of it? Like, it has to be grounded in some kind of pre-established,
and,
you know, plot,
and that's where,
or character.
And that's where this episode failed enormously, is just because it felt like there was a lot of connective tissue missing. You know, the scene in the pawn shop, they just kind of popped up. Like, what drove them to the pawn shop? What drove them to the battle sequence? I mean, what drove these characters where?
They lightly explained it at the very beginning before they did the raid. It was like, okay,
yeah,
our intel
and look,
that we never heard about, yeah.
Will you excuse me if I kind of check out every time I see an interstitial transition, you know, between with just the highways? I mean, it's the kind of thing that this show, God, you and I have been kind of the same about this. We've wanted every reason to give up with it, but then this one, to me, it showed us the most efficacy it could possibly have. It showed us the ceiling as much as it could, but, like, we're still seeing that floor, you know? I mean, with all this greatness, you know, in the battle scene, and really, I have a tangent about the overarching narrative a little bit, too, but Simeon's character's still as uninteresting as ever.
What do you think I don't know. So it's kind of funny. Like, I like Vince Vaughn as a more sober, like, mean, controlled version.
And look,
right?
I don't think it's Vince Vaughn's fault. I think it's the writing. The writing has significantly let him down. And, you know, the same writing that's done Kitsch a huge favor has and really done Velcoro a huge favor, has really been a disservice to, you know, Rachel McAdams' character and Vince Vaughn's character, just because, you know, both of them have such huge gaping holes in everything.
Yeah, no, it really is pretty interesting, though, because you look at, like, I don't understand what the point of Frank's story is to a certain degree. We're halfway through the season. I don't know if it can be salvaged, and he has the least connection. Like, he talked to Velcoro twice now, maybe three times, I guess, you know, and there's still a kind of a loose connection between the two. Like, I was thinking this is like he signed some deal with the devil, now he's under his little strings, but that's not really the case here because there's not enough connection between the two. And then,
well, he signed a deal with the devil, the devil died, and now he's trying to become the devil. Is kind of
well, no, I'm talking about the Velcoro versus Simeon, where we saw that scene where he walked into that completely red room, you know, lighted room and all that stuff, right? And then Annie's character, it's like, she literally, I to this point, I kind of think that, you know, Pizzolatto took too much criticism to heart. He made Annie, and Annie is too much of a character, which is a shame because Rachel McAdams is so phenomenal of an actress.
Yeah, I agree. Really quick, I do have something, though, that I noticed this episode that does also kind of elevate the material and might make might motivate me to stick with it if you're ready to hear that.
Let's see. Okay, go ahead.
Overall, I think shows are really great when there's like a thesis statement. Take Breaking Bad for instance. What made Breaking Bad so great is kind of. It's an excellent narrative, and it has a little bit of everyone, but at its root, the thesis statement was how power affects people.
Technically, it was let's take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface, but...
No, but, like, at its root, would you agree with me that, you know, Breaking Bad, it's all the things that it does, at its core, the thesis statement is how do men react to power?
I would say that, and it's kind of a study of whether what's more important, intentions or actions.
Yeah, you know, so that's kind of, I mean, that's a good point, too. I mean, I was just trying to simplify it for my argument's sake, but let's go ahead and...
I'll throw you a bone and just go with yours.
Yeah. but now in this season of True Detective, I think I finally am starting to get it. there's so much imagery and so much, kind of... cat tips to basically inheritance and, you know, parentage, if you will, about how evil is passed on and, you know, impurities are passed on from one person to the next. This episode was probably the most notable just because the Velcoro scene with his son, right? You know, he gives him his father's, which is, you know, the kid's grandfather's badge. And that's kind of an inheritance where Velcoro is a broken character and has so much wrong about him. He's not even supposed to see his son. But, you know, there's such this importance and emphasis set on what am I passing on? And really, that's where all the other characters, it's really interesting to see how that is with everyone else. Just because, you know, there's dysfunction in the terms of Woodrow is what is being passed on from his mother. And, you know, the combat stuff is very fascinating and, you know, but it's still this dysfunction, right? You know, is the homosexuality a dysfunction? And, you know, I don't want to get into that, you know, nature versus nurture debate. But then we look at, Simeon. Simeon right now, when it's all said and done, the scenes with Kelly Riley, with his wife, about, you know, there's some kind of blatant imagery at the beginning of this episode where his avocado seeds won't grow. And
then, I was thinking about that too.
And then his scene.
I was like, oh, come on.
and you know, I can kind of, I'm starting to see this overall thesis take picture, if that makes sense. And not that means that it's working, but it's the kind of thing that the first three episodes, I wasn't seeing this, you know. This episode deserves credit not only for that set piece, but also for, you know, they're starting to form this, you know, overarching theme. Instead of just being a mystery that no one knows what the hell is going on.
Well, I think to a certain degree it was you introduce these four different dysfunctional characters, right? And it's kind of like these four dysfunctional characters are going to have their lives, I guess, shaped a little bit where they actually have to take some, you know, action and make some more decisions to see if they can actually fix or move on from what they have, you know? And they each different character, for the most part, has grown a different way. Simeon's become more in control as he's having, you know, all of his money's gone and his his home life's breaking down. He's become more controlled, you know, more cruel in some degrees. You know, Annie's having, you know, the whole thing with her father and her sister, and now she's going to get in trouble. She's actually kind of like the slowest one in that regard, because she really hasn't. I think that like, ending scene's probably going to be the biggest factor for how she develops. Velcoro, obviously, we saw from the get-go, you know, in dealing with his son. And then, obviously, Paul Woodrow, in some ways, I think Woodrow's the best done character so far from a writing standpoint. But maybe it's just Taylor Kitsch, who's probably the, one of the better physical actors on anything right now.
It's tough to say with Colin Farrell on the same screen, but I think that Taylor Kitsch has the best acting chops of everyone.
See, I think Colin Farrell's the better actor, because I think Taylor Kitsch, while he succeeds in, like I said, the pure physical acting, and while I think he did a great job in the, oh, this is a terrible idea, but you should marry me to his, you know, pregnant girlfriend.
Oh, no, that scene was... Like I said, that's purely a cover, and he played it. We could see right through.
Phenomenal, yeah.
We could see right through it, and that's good. We're supposed to see right through it.
Yeah, well, I was trying to say, at the same time, though, it's like, even though that scene was great, obviously, it's just, I think Taylor Kitsch sometimes isn't, he's not as effective in the delivering dialogue, but he is such a strong physical actor, and that's why the show's done a great job playing to his strengths.
Yeah, you know, yeah, giving him, you know, being a man of few words, and, you know, he just, what is it, the this is you, when he's, you know, leaving his girlfriend. I mean, there's... I agree. You know, there's such a good job of playing to Kitsch's strengths that I just wish that it was, you know, that way across the board. You know, I still stand by what I said, is that, you know, this show hasn't done enough to justify its time for me, but I am seeing, you know, I'm seeing some ceilings, so it's good.
It's pretty much to a certain degree, right? I these are the characters, okay? Velcoro is clearly a character that he's an idea for a while, right? Taylor Kitsch, he talked to, apparently, Pizzolatto talked to for, like, in a bar for, like, 9 hours. Like, that's what David told me, right? And he's discussing this character for him. So he had a clear vision for that, right? Simeon feels like he had this idea for what he wanted, like, you know, like I said, the incorporated city and his, like, you know, whatever. He had this idea for it, and then he kind of rushed to get it done, so it doesn't make any sense to me. I really don't know why Vince Vaughn was cast this role. And Annie just, like, he took all the criticism to heart, but he forgot to write a character within that, you know, structure for the character to a certain degree. And it's interesting to see, because after that ending, right, I can't imagine it's just going to be like, well, here's the next morning from that, you know, from that encounter. Because pretty much everyone from the entire force there has been killed, except for the three main characters. They're going to be notably shaken up, so somehow the structure of this show is going to have to change here.
Yeah, you know, and you know, we might have a time jump or a huge locale change coming up, which might be some fresh air, but I you know, there's not enough foundation, I don't think, laid to earn that. And that's the thing, is that a lot
but
of...
But we don't have enough foundation to build to continue on where we're at either, so...
Yeah, and that's... Man, just nothing... So little about this show feels earned so far, and I'm a guy, you know, you need to earn it for me, and, you know, there's so many shows that earn it so well. Mad Men earns it so well, and, you know, Breaking Bad earns it, and this show is almost going through the motions, and you know, just being the sympathetic guy really quick, I mean, if you watch this show as kind of a parody, or, you know, take some things at not face value, then, you know, it becomes a little bit better and a little easier to stomach. But, I don't know.
Well, I think that's pretty much a good stopping point there. It's kind of funny. Like, I feel like my dad said it best. To a certain degree, it was boring until the ending, right? And that's not saying every element was boring. I think the Taylor Kitsch stuff was done really well this episode, but...
Look, I agree. I mean, if something's boring, it's boring. I mean, some people think Birdman's boring. And, frankly, I don't disagree with them, but, you know.
So, something that I wasn't going to talk about that I just found out got released is the 2015 Emmy nominations, right?
Okay, I'll go ahead and bring that up. I didn't know that was released either, so...
So, when did they start doing 7 shows for drama and comedy? Because they have 7 nominees. Is that something new?
Okay, well, do you want to go ahead and talk about it really quick? I mean, I've got
to
look
So we have, obviously, Better Call Saul for drama, which obviously, that's probably our
Just read them, I mean, and then we can talk about shows we think are worth noting.
Okay, so Better Call Saul, Downton Abbey, or you know, whatever, Downton Abbey. I always think of, like, when Harry Potter is, like, Diagon Alley, you know, instead of Diagon Alley, when he throws the bloom. That's why.
Diagonally?
Diagonally, yeah. Anyways, Game of Thrones, Homeland, House Guards, Mad Men, Orange New Black. For comedy, you have Louis, Modern Family, Parks and Rec, Silicon Valley, Transparent, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and Veep.
Well,
right?
Hang on. Do you want to just break down? I think it might be better if we just break down the, you know, let's do it by category instead of just reading the list.
I just wanted real quick, just those are the series, but with drama, obviously, Better Call Saul is, like I said, the right now consensus.
I'll say, if I had to power rank this, Mad Men ended phenomenally. In terms of, you know, gosh, it went under the radar, but I think Mad Men ended phenomenally. I don't think it's going to be Breaking Bad where it's ending with, you know, booms and applauses and, you know, a sweep to boot. Better Call Saul was the best show I saw this year.
So it's interesting if you look at this list. Like, okay, so I think this is like the weaker one. I think this is the weakest season of Game of Thrones. I think Homeland hasn't been a real show in a while. I stopped
watching. House of Cards. This was the worst season.
It's definitely. I hated the second half. Orange and New Black started off really strong. Season one. I have not seen season three, but I haven't heard the best things about it.
Season three is. Have you seen season two?
I've seen, like, half of season two.
Okay, well, this season was about exactly, you know, tonally and, you know, the highs and the lows. This season was about what season two was.
Okay, so it's kind of like, it's probably not worthy for, you know, it's got high moments that are great, but as an overall package, it's probably not worthy.
You've got two shows that have done something special. Mad Men and Better Call Saul are special. Orange is the New Black, I mean, against those shows, being very good isn't enough. So I'd be surprised if Mad Men didn't win it. If I were to vote, I'd probably vote Better Call Saul, though.
I'm trying to think, though, in terms of, like, this hasn't... Like, obviously, you have The Americans, which will never get nominated for anything ever. I'm trying to think of what other shows pretty much could have been
The snubs, so to speak.
Yeah, to a certain degree. I haven't obviously watched enough to really have a full grasp.
Empire might be one that might belong there, but even then, it has no chance of winning, I don't think. Like I said, I'm looking at that Better Call Saul and Mad Men as the only two things with a chance of winning.
And to a certain degree, it's kind of sad that it's just Better Call Saul and Mad Men. I feel like in a lot of more years, especially, like, remember, like, I think it was, like, House of Cards Season 1, right? And you had Game of Thrones, and you had Breaking Bad, and you had Mad Men, and you had Downton Abbey when people liked that show. You know, that was a much more stark, and even, like, early Homeland, Season 1 of Homeland, you know, that was a much stronger time period to what we're looking at right now.
It is and it isn't. The strength of right now is how much there is. I mean, the top isn't what it was. There's no, you know, there's no 79 Dolphins. There's no, you know, is it 76?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There's no truly great historic teams so much anymore. But there's
72 Dolphins.
72.
Man. You're not even close.
I knew there was a 7 in there. But you know, right now, Mad Men. Like I said, Mad Men. I thought the way it ended was something special. Just, you know, in terms of that final season, that final half season, it was remarkable in terms of, you know, what it accomplished. And I'm trying to say it without really spoiling anything, but, like, let's talk about that thesis theory that I have.
I know the ending. Everyone knows the ending.
Not the ending. I mean, just, like, I try not to focus on the ending because the ending is divisive, and I'm not even sure how I feel about the ending. But the final season... You know, it explores, like, you know, this thesis of goodbyes and farewells in a way that's very endearing and very, you know, very deep. I mean, it's just, that's the easiest way to put it.
I'm trying to think, the other shows, so you can say, like, Justified last season, which I need to watch Justified. It's one of my next
like I said, as good as Justified is, I don't think it belongs with these.
Rectify on Sundance, which is apparently, I would watch it other than the fact that apparently it's super depressing.
Well, yeah.
On The Leftovers, which I want to watch, but it's just such a slow show.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think what else.
Well,
I mean,
Walking
like...
Dead might have been able to sneak a nomination, but no, we're not even gonna get into that. So
you're trying to rile me up here.
Yeah. No, we're pretty much you know, Better Call Saul or Mad Men, right? Or lean Better Call Saul just because you haven't seen Mad Men.
Well, yeah, literally by default, I lean Better Call Saul.
Okay.
There's not really
outstanding comedy then. Let's kind of move on.
So, unfortunately for me, like, I have not, so I'm like, this is pretty funny, right? I've seen about 3/5 of Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I've almost finished season 6 of Parks and Rec.
So, really quick, do you know the answer to this? Yeah. Is this season 6 or season 5 being nominated? For Louis.
For what? When did the last season start?
Well, if it's the one on Netflix, then it makes it this makes it tough for me. If it's season 5 of Louis, it makes it tough.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out it's season 5.
Okay, then. I know what I'm talking about now. Okay. So really quick.
There's only 5 seasons. Though,
have you said them yet? I'll say them really quick. So Louis, Modern Family, Parks and Rec, Silicon Valley, Transparent, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and Veep. Okay. So I'm going to rule out Transparent and Parks and Rec. As much as I liked Parks and Rec, this was kind of the somber goodbye instead of the, you know, hit it with a bang.
It lost. It's kind of like Community, where like it lost a lot of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
Though I don't like. It's kind of funny. So season 6, my little sister loves the show, and I'm on season 6 right now. So it's kind of funny. Like with Parks and Rec, Silicon Valley, and Louis, I'm close, but I haven't seen. Like I'll probably see him before the Emmys, but I'm not there yet, which is kind of funny. But like it's still kind of like a lot of the cast is gone. You can cross off Modern Family is going to win it, but I used to watch a lot of Modern Family, but that show has never really been worthy.
And I really hope it doesn't, because
it's one every year.
Because Louis's deserving, because I've been telling, you know, David, I've been telling David without actually telling David, in terms of a half hour comedy, Louis, there's a 5 episode arc in Louis that is, it's the best thing that's ever been done in a half hour of TV. It like makes a mini movie, and it's phenomenal. There's nothing like it. And it, like I said, you know, with the Fukunaga stuff, I mean, it elevates the medium to a place that it hasn't possibly reached before. That being said, season 5 has a lot of dregs, and it's one of my criticisms of the show as a whole. There's an episode where he goes to Seinfeld, invites him to a dinner, and he, you know, he's being the opening act, and he just bombs it. And some blonde thinks he's funny, and he takes him home. It's just kind of really, there's a lot of dregs to Louis in terms of season 5, but again, this is something that busted the medium and broke it open. That being said, I compared to the other two shows that I would probably vote for, Kimmy Schmidt was special, and Silicon Valley might be my nomination just because in terms of a comedy, it was the best comedy I've seen. I don't think I've laughed out loud so much as when I've watched this last episode, you know, this last season of Silicon Valley.
So you're saying is once I finish Parks and Rec, I should immediately jump on Silicon Valley.
Oh, Silicon Valley is the season 2 is phenomenal, and it's, you know, it's a half hour, 10 episodes. You'll get through it quick.
Okay, well, anyway, so that's interesting. So I can't have much to say. By the time it airs, I'll have real thoughts on at least 4 of them. I might watch Veep at some point soon, too.
Veep was one that I was, you know, you give me crap for The Wire. Veep was one that, because it's a half hour, I was thinking of that would be the one.
You should watch The Wire, though. I can't, you know, what kills me is, so David's seen the first 3 seasons, I think, or maybe, actually, no, he's seen 2.8. For some reason, he hasn't watched the ending to, like, one of the best endings of any TV show ever in The Wire, season 3's ending, which kills me still. And then you haven't seen it at all, so it's like, I can't say anything because I haven't seen Mad Men, which is the same level of prestige.
Mm-hmm.
But it would dominate The Wire for a Hall of Fame. Is that too much to ask? I just want to do it. I want to do it, Seth.
I'll try. I mean, like I said, I'm working now. I don't have the time that I used to.
Well, lead actor in a drama series.
Lead actor, this is a 2-horse race to me. It's John Hamm or Bob Odenkirk.
So it's kind of interesting. So Liev Schreiber, he's going to get nominated every year because people like him, movie guy, whatever, blah, 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 Ray Donovan, doesn't matter. Kevin Spacey, in season 1, there's a stronger argument for him. Season 3, he became more of a character for me. I don't know if it's, that's not the acting, it's just the writing, so I kind of throw him out. Jeff, no one cares about The Newsroom. Jeff Daniels shouldn't have won it when he did. He won it because of the Why America's Not the Best Country in the World speech in the pilot of The Newsroom, which I don't even like that speech because it was definitely like bait. It was like so Emmy bait. So then you're looking at, I haven't seen Bloodline. It's a 1 season on Netflix.
It's so strange. I've heard it's bad, but that's my boy, man. Kyle Chandler's my boy.
I know. I love Kyle Chandler. When he won, it's kind of funny. So he's the reason that Jon Hamm will never win an Emmy, maybe. Like, maybe they'll give it to Jon Hamm this year, but like, he's pretty much the main reason, because the 1 year Bryan Cranston couldn't steal it from him, like, because he had a year off, everyone thought Jon Hamm was going to win for The Suitcase, which apparently is, like, best Emmy episode ever. And then they gave it to Kyle Chandler, our boy.
Coach Taylor.
Coach Taylor's the best, yeah.
That being said, Bob Odenkirk, I mean, Jimmy McGill is just a fantastic character. There's just so much meat. There's a lot of Emmy bait in Jimmy McGill, just because it's such a... God, there's so much relatable search for identity, and Odenkirk plays it so well, and he's like a comedic actor. It's like Steve Carell in Foxcatcher, is that it's like this comedic role. You know, he's a comedic guy playing a serious role, but like his comedic sensibilities ground it, you know, ground the role, and just, you know, it's great. But Jon Hamm needs to win this, man. And that's the kind of what I'm curious about, is how the Emmy Academy or whatever, whoever votes for this stuff, how receptive they were to the ending of Mad Men, because I think it was divisive, and like I said, I still don't know how I feel about it. Jon Hamm needs to win this.
So I was looking at the supporting actor in the comedy list while we were talking. Do you know Michael Key got nominated for Key and Peele?
Huh.
I love that.
I think
that's fun. That's fun.
Look, man, I love Jordan Key, I love Jordan Peele. God, I love Jordan Peele, but I think that Keegan-Michael Key is the funnier of the two.
Well, he got nominated for that reason. Like, so he's. I just thought that was a great little callback. I mean,
all right.
You know.
Well, we can go ahead and, you know, I think we should just breeze through it really quick. So,
I mean,
outstanding lead actress, Elizabeth.
Tatiana Maslany got nominated, which is huge. She's in the difficult role that everyone's talked about for years, and obviously Robin Wright, House of Cards, Elizabeth Moss, Mad Men, Taraji P. Henson from Empire, Viola Davis, How to Get Away with Murder, and Claire Danes, Homeland. I watched How to Get Away with Murder for 2 episodes, stopped watching because it was terrible, but I was like, wow, Viola Davis is too good to be on the show.
And, you know, and Elizabeth Moss, you know, like I said, I'll talk about what I know. I think that she's deserving, but, you know, I'm not sure how good everything else is. Robin Wright had herself a solid season, but I didn't like this season, man. I didn't like it.
I didn't really either. All
right.
Lead actress in a comedy series, Eddie Falco for Nurse Jackie. It's kind of funny how she went from her, she was in Sopranos, you know, to the Nurse Jackie perpetual nominee.
Jeffrey Tambor might win this. He's already kind of been sweeping the mini awards.
I skipped lead actor. I went straight to lead actress.
Oh, my
bad. So, you know, No. Sorry. Lead actor is Anthony Anderson from Blackish, Louis C.K., obviously, show. Don Cheadle, House of Lies, Will Forte, Last Man on Earth, Matt LeBlanc episodes, William H. Macy, Shameless, Jeffrey Tambor, Transparent.
This is strange. I could see it going a variety of ways. Will Forte might be my lead, but I think Louis C.K. should win it.
I think Jeffrey Tambor will end up winning it,
yeah,
though.
Like I said, Tambor, he's been sweeping the mini circuits. Like, I think he already got the Golden Globe for it.
And I love him in Arrested Development.
Like I said, though, Louis C.K. should get it because of that 5-episode arc in season 5. I think it's Elevator is what it's called. It's not important.
Elevator is season 4. I think you're mixing up. Like what's like season 5, right? Is the newest season? There's 8 episodes on. That's the newest season that's going to be in the Emmys.
Oh.
Season 4 has Elevator, which has already been the Emmys. They've already done that one. So you're on the wrong one.
Okay, go ahead. Lead actress. We already did that.
Kind of, yeah. It's neon on point. Like,
it's probably Julia Louis-Dreyfus, just because I think they love her.
Maybe they'll get Amy Poehler on the way out.
Maybe.
Let's see. Supporting actor coverage. Like I said, Key and Peele is the main one worth noticing. We also have Andre Brower, Adam Driver, Tess Burgess, Tony Hale, Ty Burrell. Supporting actress. I don't know. For the most, like, these are all. We don't really want to go too detailed about any of these.
Outstanding supporting actor in a drama. Jonathan Banks or The Field.
Jonathan Banks. Okay, so you have like a lot of the same people. Michael Kelly. It's good to see Michael Kelly nominated, but not for this season. This is the wrong season to nominate Michael Kelly for House of Cards.
Yeah, I love me some Dinklage, but.
Yeah, whatever.
I still look at him. I think it's 5-0, right? Jonathan Banks, man. That guy can act.
Okay, supporting actors in a drama series. So. You have someone from Downton Abbey, Joan Froggatt, Lena Headey, Emily Clark from Game of Thrones, Christina Berninski for Good Wife, Christina Hendricks from Mad Men, Lisa Abdul, Well, who's Uzo Aduba?
Uzo Aduba is a Crazy Eyes.
Oh, she's Crazy Eyes? Ah, okay. So, I don't know. I don't even know why, like, Daenerys is nominated again for this, but I guess Lena Headey has a better taste for that one. Lena Headey might actually win it for one episode.
I don't know, man. She was really good this season as a whole.
She's always really good. She's always really good. She's always been one of the best, and she's definitely always been more deserving, in my opinion, than Emilia Clarke, but it's just, she has one episode that really stands out, I think, the season, obviously The Walk of Shame, so that might win it for her.
Yeah, I think it will, just because, you know, as much as I liked Hendrix, as much as I liked, you know, Daenerys, I mean, the only, I think that Cersei's had the most depth of the ones I've seen.
See, now I'm trying to find, like, the directing nominees. Which to me is like the more interesting one to start to give.
Supporting actor in a comedy. You already talked about that.
I've already kind of just kind of blown these things because
of course speaking of Andre Brower, I've started watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It is fantastic. It is so good.
Okay, so this is my plan. Okay, finish Parks and Rec, finish season 2 of Silicon Valley, then watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Like that's my comedy list right now.
Supporting actress in a comedy.
Well, I guess they're not updated, but so they have writing, right? The writing awards up. And for drama, you have 5-0. You have Mother's Mercy for Game of Thrones. Mother's Mercy was...
Mother's Mercy was the one where Sansa gets raped.
No, Mother's Mercy is the finale.
Is it? What am I thinking of? Don't listen to me with anything.
Okay, then there's two Mad Men episodes, Lost Horizon and Person to Person.
Person to Person is the finale, so... And Lost Horizon is the season 5 second half starter.
Okay, then the Americans episode. Do male robots dream of electric sheep? Great title. Then you have episodes, Who Cares, Louis, Bobby's House, Silicon Valley, 2 Days of the Condor, Last Man on Earth Alive, and Tuska on the pilot of Transparent, and Election Night for Veep. Yeah, this is compelling stuff as we're learning about this stuff right now.
maybe we can do a preview of it just, you know, so we can have time to digest some of this.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. So I want to give a shout out to one person that wasn't nominated that I wish was Jimmy Smits. You know, do you ever watch Dexter?
I've watched the first episode and I thought, wow, this, I'm not sure I could buy this show, but go ahead.
Okay, so he was in NYPD Blue, he's the West Wing, L.A. Law, right? But he's also in Dexter, and he's in Sons of Anarchy. And I kind of wish he was nominated for the last season of Sons of Anarchy, but I realize that I'm the only person I know who watches Sons of Anarchy. So I just want to shout that out there as a guy who I thought maybe could have been nominated.
Here we go. Outstanding. Oh, you already said this. I think it's got to go to Person to Person.
Also, Walton Goggins from Justified. I just from watching him in Community, I'm pretty sure he's the best thing ever. Like the one episode of Community he's in, I'm pretty sure he's the best thing ever in Justified. That's my thought process on him.
Ah, okay. Jon Hamm might win an Emmy anyway.
For what?
For being a guest actor in a comedy series. Because as Reverend Richard Wayne Gary Wayne in Unbreakable Kim Schmidt, basically, oh gosh, you saw Jon.
Can we make? Do you think he'll be making, like, different, like, appearances on, like, various shows from now on, try to get the guest win?
I think that Mad Men has taken up so much time and so much effort mentally, physically, emotionally, whatever, that it's hard to jump right back into one, you know?
Honestly, I think he'll just be, like, a guest role in a bunch of shows because he wants to win an Emmy.
Do I know something that I didn't know?
What?
Phil Lord and Christopher Miller directed the pilot of Last Man on Earth.
Really? I did not know that either.
I might watch that now.
It's kind of funny. It's like, so you saw the his appearance in 30 Rock, both of his appearances in 30 Rock, you know?
Yeah.
I guess he made three.
Let's see. He was Jenna's husband, and he was the Twilight guy.
Anyway, so I think he's nominated three times for his guest role in 30 Rock and didn't win once, which that's the only episodes I've seen of 30 Rock.
The Twilight one?
No, just every time Jon Hamm's been on the show.
Oh, Jon Hamm in 30 Rock. Oh, God. Yeah, no, he was the doctor. He was the doctor in 30 Rock that Liz Lemon dates, and he's a pretty guy that's just a dope.
I just like him on the live shows.
Yeah.
More so than anybody. He didn't win for that. I can't imagine he'll ever win for anything. That's my new theory on that. Anyways, we should probably get out of here.
Yeah.
I guess the only thing I really want to say about these Emmys is, if Jonathan Banks doesn't win, I'm going to smash something.
For supporting act. Yeah, no, there's nothing on there. Let me check. Just, I know I'm, like, totally killing your weekend buzz, boy, but, supporting actor in a drama, Jonathan Banks, and no one. Yeah, no, if he doesn't win, I'll smack something.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's all I got for this week. We'll probably another time go more in depth when we're not as thrust upon this, you know, at the last second.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, no, it was total crap. We'll have something good for you next week, hopefully.
Hey, I like their True Detective analysis. And watch 7 Days in Hell. Watch 7 Days in Hell. And I'm sure David hasn't had his passionate defense of True Detective yet.
like I said, his defense is going to be that we don't understand it, or some crap like that.
We didn't watch enough companion pieces. It's like people who defend Halo's plot. Look, I read 9 different companion pieces to Halo's plot. It's the greatest story ever made. And I'm playing the game, I'm like, I have no idea where any of this information that you know comes from, and that's pretty much why, because it's all in books. And that's
David's
like...
I know we're getting out, but, like, True Detective, like I said, the biggest sympathizers for the show right now are the ones who cling to it being, like, a self-parody or something. And there was a scene in this last episode. Okay, that's what it was. The argument with Simeon and his wife. There was a scene, the line that was, so we're going to be one of those arguing couples. I thought that was such a piece of crap line. Then I thought about it as meta, and I'm like, if that's a meta line, that's pretty hilarious.
It's kind of funny how, like, anything can be better if you think of it as meta. Like, things that are terrible are usually great as meta.
Well, I mean, yeah, pretty much. And that's the thing, is that, like, look, if you want to put that much effort into watching your show just so you can enjoy it, I'll be over in the corner watching SpongeBob. I know that. It gets me, okay? So
I told you. Why did she write your paper, SpongeBob? Why? Why?
I don't know.
It's the tightest full circle. Back to that reference.
I'm really sad David hasn't been here, because I want to hear his defense, because I won't say it's been indefensible, but it's been pretty damn indefensible.
Hopefully he'll be back next week, and we'll probably get to hear his points, and it'll be entertaining. He's actually told me some things that I can't tell you in, like, confidentiality about the show, but I can't say anything about it. I can't. Like, I have to just kind of hide that. It's because he doesn't want to, you know, he's going to be defending the show, right? So I can't tell you what he's told me.
Has it changed your opinion?
What, Davis told me?
Yeah.
No, I'm saying, he said he's had, like, criticism of the show that I'm not allowed to say or repeat, so he can actually then praise it next week.
SMH, man, SMH.
All right, let's get out of here. I really want
to.
See y'all next week, everyone.